Hello there, I'm Max Kaiser. This is the Kaiser Report. I'm here with Stacey Herbert. We're gonna be talking about stuff. Stacey.
Max. So you know what happened this past week?
No.
Amazon went through $1,000 a share.
Right.
That was big news. Apple is close to that. Apple is heading towards $1 trillion a share. I remember with Michael Pinto when we were in New York, you spoke of the FANG shares. Well, everybody's talking about the FANG shares now, except for now it's also the FANG shares because you have to include Adobe, ADBE, on this ticker tape. They're up 38% so far this year, and AVGO, which is Broadcom, another tech company, and that's up 36% this year. So now they've come up with a new acronym, and it's FANG.
Well, I mean, these are platform companies. Amazon is a platform, Facebook's a platform, Google's a platform, or Alphabet as it's called now. So they own, you know, Facebook's got 2 billion users, just about. So it's bigger than any country in the world. And they have, you know, I see Mark Zuckerberg wants to do universal basic income. He supports that concept. And I'm pretty sure it's because they want to be the company to distribute the universal basic income to all its 2 billion users. And of course, that would bring in another 2 billion users. And so they're worth $400 billion, $800 billion, $1 trillion in market cap. But I've been saying now for 5 years that there's no reason to think these companies are not going to continue to go higher. I mean, by the standard measure of valuation, they're at the top end. But you can't use a standard measure of valuation because of the dominance that they have. More than any monopoly of the past, more than Standard Oil, more than any dominant monopolist that was broken up during the robber baron era, U.S. Steel and others. These are much more dominant. They're global, and the cost of scaling, you don't need to pay high-priced workers. You just need to get another server. That server can handle another million users, and so the economies of scale. Apple profit margins are still in the 60%, I believe, for these phones. And that is an unbelievable margin. Compare that to a grocery store where the margin might be at most 1%.
Yes, that's with Walmart. It's,
right. Walmart,
it's about 1%, 2%.
Margins are 1%, 2%. Amazon, the margins are incredibly higher because they have Amazon Web Services, which is online cloud servicing. Again, the margins are spectacular. So these, you can't look at the earnings. The earnings are whatever Jeff Bezos wants them to be at any particular quarter. That's true of any CEO of any Fortune 500 company. And they don't like to pay taxes, so they tend to understate earnings. And so they've got room to go until such time as something else comes along to compete for
the
investment dollar.
Well, or unless something comes along like a real Teddy Roosevelt to break up these monopolies, because they are monopoly, oligopoly positions, and they are able, we've covered it, for example, that Facebook and Google, and Google stays Google for this purpose because of the fact that without a G at the end of, we would have no FANG, we would have FAN. So we keep the G for Google, it is Alphabet now. But Facebook and Google capture almost all of the new growth in advertising revenue, so at some point, some administration, some legislator might come along and try to break it up. In particular, if there is a competitor in their district who is against these monopolies.
Well, think about the empire of Rupert Murdoch, who shrewdly bought media companies and newspapers to influence politics in the United Kingdom. He gave us Tony Blair. And Tony Blair gave Rupert Murdoch billions and billions of dollars of monopoly franchise value. Now, look at Facebook. Facebook filters our news. So, yeah, there could be an attempt to break up a monopoly, but who's going to know about it? And they get their news from Facebook.
Well, look it up. I don't have all the details here, and I don't have the headline here, but Sheryl Sandberg was found in Ireland. I believe there was some information that came out that she was speaking to ministers there, that she wanted, she basically helped them pick the person to be their information minister, mm-hmm. the person who would be in control of any data retention policies.
Well, it's no accident that companies like Amazon and others are talking about building settlements on the moon. In other words, they see Earth as having been conquered. They already own Earth. Amazon owns Earth, everything from A to Z. If you look at their logo, the arrow goes from A to Z. They own it all. They get a commission on everything. And Alibaba, of course, is a competitor, but they have a duopoly, essentially, in the globe's e-commerce business. But they consider Earth to have been conquered. We are slaves now on Earth to these companies. They're looking at other planets to go after, other satellites, other moons. They're going out into the solar system.
Yeah, but I did see Josh Brown, downtown Josh Brown, a reformed broker on Twitter, tweet something along the lines of, Jeff Bezos says, let's go to the moon. The Tesla guy says, let's go to Mars. And Warren Buffett says, let's buy Pepsi. So he is quite earthbound and yet quite wealthy. Jeff Bezos is wealthier. But I want to turn to this headline from Zero Hedge because, you know, the NASDAQ has quadrupled since the 2007-2008 crash. It's now past the 2000 highs. You know, you were there for the first dot-com boom. So now, of course, everybody... We've already covered everybody's calling for a crash in the Dow and the S&P 500, but now people are starting to look at the NASDAQ and see whether or not we might be in tech boom 2.0, dot-com boom 2.0. And that is the first crack appears in the second tech bubble. So Zero Hedge is already declaring it's a tech bubble. 4 weeks ago, Goldman pointed out that in 2017, just 10 companies are responsible for half of the S&P's rally year to date, with the top five, Apple, Facebook, Amazon, Google, and Microsoft, have accounted for nearly 40% of returns. A few days later, then Bank of America showed that annualized tech inflows are now the strongest this century, running at an unprecedented 25% of AUM, which is funds under management, which Bank of America dubbed a sign of renewed exuberance.
Right. It was only maybe 3 years ago that the biggest company by market cap was ExxonMobil. And it was big news when Apple overtook ExxonMobil in market capitalization. And now I think four or five companies have overtaken ExxonMobil in terms of market capitalization. And you still have huge continents to conquer, India, China. These are huge populations, Indonesia, that will be succumb to Amazon and Google and Facebook. And the margins are high, and the ability to scale is virtually infinite. And the management teams are the best that we've seen in 150 years in America. These are, you mentioned the dot-com boom and crash, $5 trillion got wiped out. There were a few survivors. Google, you had eBay, and three or four others went on to become now close to trillion-dollar companies, Apple Computer, although it's not really a dot-com. And so this is a phenomenon that will continue to percolate. As far as cracks go in the facade, and where is this a crash material? Of course, it is overdue for a pullback, for sure. But you know, there's no other game in town. Where are you going to put your money? Gold and silver have been flatlining for half a decade.
Yeah.
Bitcoin and cryptocurrency, it's a $60 billion market versus Apple's $1 trillion market cap. Sure, it'll go to half a trillion soon enough, but probably not enough to knock Apple off its perch. So where else do you go?
You know, one thing to look at is, as the article in Zero Hedge points out, that not in a decade have the multiples, the PE multiples, been so high on the NASDAQ. But of course, I think a lot of people forget that the dot-com crash wiped out a lot of money, and people learned the lesson for a genuine generation, unlike the subprime mortgage collapse, which a lot of investors didn't actually lose any money because they got bailed out. In 2000, they didn't get bailed out, and those people haven't stayed away for so long for real because they didn't want to get burnt again. But now, as I said, the assets under management, this is a chart they show that the tech inflows are the strongest in 15 years. So, you know, all through the last, this was all during the subprime, the housing bubble, the last housing bubble. Now you see that it's soaring. Everybody's pouring all of their money into the tech sector. Of course, Warren Buffett, as I mentioned, has become a huge investor in Apple after decades of not participating in Apple.
Yeah, I mean, I wonder what Carl Icahn is thinking, because he sold Berkshire Hathaway / Warren Buffett their stake in Apple. Came from Carl Icahn, for the most part, who had made a big score on his Apple stock, but has given up huge upside. I wonder if he regrets that sell decision. He was also at that time talking about a crash is imminent, markets are overvalued. I mean, this is how it works, Stacey. Stephen Cohen, who had the SAC fund, I believe it was called. They got in trouble. They shut it down. People went breaking the law. Some folks
went insider trading.
Insider trading. Stephen Cohen, the guy who ran it, was untouched. He's coming back into the market with a $20 billion hedge fund.
Yeah, in 2018.
Right, and he'll be buying these stocks to riding the momentum.
Yeah.
And so if you're not going to apply any rules of law to financiers, to hedge funds, and it's completely open season, and you have a few oligopolists who can scale virtually without any cost, you know, you're going to have these things continue to race ahead. And eventually, yeah, you'll have a correction, but...
Yes, for every buyer, there's a seller. And as we're saying, the assets under management, all the smart money is pouring into the tech sector. The NASDAQ is hitting all-time highs. But this is with the crack that Zero Hedge is talking about, are the ETFs, the tech ETF, the tech sector ETF. So as the chart shows, investors pulled more than $716 million from the most popular technology exchange-traded fund last week, the $17.4 billion tech sector selector SPDR fund, or XLK, is the largest weekly outflow in over a year. You can see that these were the sellers. The buyers were the likes of Warren Buffett. So one of them is going to be wrong ultimately. Maybe they were calling the top. Who knows?
Well, ETFs are a derivative. You know, it's not the actual stocks themselves. And there are more ETFs and derivatives than there are stocks. So the action amongst that derivative market is huge. You know, there's hundreds of trillions of dollars in derivatives versus, you know, it's a 50 to 60 times bigger than the actual physical slash stock market. So, again, it's hard to extrapolate a lot of meaningful trends from that kind of whipsawing in a derivative market when you have the fundamentals, if you will, of this tech sector impacted so profoundly by the fact that company like Facebook with 2 billion users, heading to 4 billion users, Apple Computer, huge gross profit margins. I mean, this is a new world, essentially.
It's also a new generation, Max. So many people out there watching this won't have been even maybe born in 2000 when the dot-com bubble crashed. So they're talking about how high the multiples are now, and it's like 24.4. of PE ratio. I'm sure you remember when it was like 240 was the average PE ratio.
Well, the dot-com height, it was almost 100 amongst a certain group of stocks. So you got a lot of room there. I mean, it could double from here before you get to the old valuation, according to those numbers.
Yeah, and of course, into that is a new generation. As I said, we're in a new generation. They're exposed to the crypto market. The crypto market is now merging with the tech sector. These are also companies that could be IPOing if they feel like no longer ICOing, which is initial coin offering. So there's a lot of money out there, a lot of new billionaires, millionaires, 100 millionaires from the Bitcoin, from the Maxcoin, from the Ethers. There are hundreds of cryptocurrencies out there and thousands of new millionaires to invest in this sector as well.
Let 10,000 billionaires bloom. All right, well, we got to go to the second half after the break. Don't go away.
Anywhere else.
This story was almost completely left out of the Western mainstream press.
You won't see it anywhere else.
This is not talked about on CNN because it's not allowed.
You won't see it anywhere else.
Things you'll hear on Crosstalk.
Pag ako nasa ilalim, ako yung nagdadasal ng sana makabatwa.
Maraming lumawa na kami ng isang tao, ang isang pana sa ilalim.
You had orders to close mines, but how do you make sure that the unofficial mines are closed? Does anyone inspect, check?
Yes.
Yes?
Pero pinapatigil pa kami ng gobyerno dahil ito ay bawal, illegal.
paano aputik ba kanini ang siyang inaanuhan? Eh si Harold nga, minsan may ayaw kong pakabudin yan, ay napunta na lang at basabi yung wala tayo na naibigas. Masama muna ako sa mga pinsang ko.
Yan, tinatawag naming hanap buhay na patay.
Welcome back to the Kaiser Report. I'm Max Kaiser. Time now to go to Jameson Lopp, engineer at Bitco. Jameson, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
All right, this is going to be very exciting now. You tweeted, those who scoffed at the thought of $1,000 Bitcoin are scoffing at the $10,000 price for Bitcoin and will scoff at $100,000 per Bitcoin. What's going on?
Well, of course, I don't mean to make any near-term price predictions. I'm a very long-term, bullish, crypto and self-sovereign kind of guy. But really, I mean, even today, with these massive bubbles that we've been seeing in the crypto economy, it's still just a drop in the bucket compared to the rest of the world. And so many people have yet to even begin to grasp what's going on, that the idea of 10 or 100, possibly even $1 million bitcoins is not outside of the realm of possibility.
Right. I remember when Rick Fogvinja up there in Stockholm, 2011, when Bitcoin was $20 or $30, Bitcoin was talking about $100,000 Bitcoin based on Bitcoin grabbing a percentage of global foreign exchange market. And now here we are 5-6 years later. Couple of things. Number one, you're not alone in talking about $100,000 Bitcoin. It's been talked about on CNBC and other mainstream outlets now. And the idea of it grabbing a percentage of foreign exchange market is becoming more talked about because this is where this token, this currency is going, right?
Definitely. And of course, you have so many people who are using it for different things, and a lot of the debate that's going on in the community is digital gold versus payment rails. And I've actually seen some very interesting analysis that says, you know, if you look at Bitcoin as a payment rail competing against Visa, MasterCard, whatever, that is actually tiny in comparison to using Bitcoin as a digital gold, as a store of value. So if we're really going for the store of value, we have a much larger market where we only have to capture a smaller share of the market in order for the price to go to the moon, as they say.
Right. I mean, I got involved with Bitcoin at that conference with Rick Fogvinja back in 2011 when the price was $3 a Bitcoin. And to me, it was always a store of value. It was always digital gold. It was, so as you point out, that market is huge. And but this whole scaling debate kind of gets back to this, whether it's a store of value versus a mechanism of transfer of value mechanism, a rail system, a rail of transactions. And so where are we at the scaling debate? Because you were moderating a panel at Consensus in New York, and this has gone on now for a couple of years. Can you just explain what the debate is and where are we in the debate?
The debate is a result of technical limitations with the protocol in the fact that transactions have to go into blocks, and blocks only happen every 10 minutes, and they can only be about a megabyte, have a few thousand transactions. So the resulting technical attribute of the system is you can only really do about 3 to 5 transactions per second globally on the Bitcoin network, which is pitiful in comparison to something like Visa or MasterCard. But if you are looking at more of a digital gold, then it doesn't even compare. I mean, good luck trying to send gold across the world in a matter of minutes.
Well, let's talk about the Satoshi Nakamoto white paper, which came out in 2008 and really set the stage for this whole thing. How would he address this debate, the scaling debate, based on what's in the actual white paper? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, in the white paper, he did speak about something called simplified payment verification, or SPV, which is a way that you can use Bitcoin without running a full node and without having to necessarily use all of the resources required for a full validation. But unfortunately, SPV has not yet gotten to the point that a lot of us would like in terms of security. You're still vulnerable to a few potential attacks of nodes lying to you. So like there are a number of different ways that we can scale and make it easier to use Bitcoin without having as many computational resources. But Satoshi did not quite fulfill his vision. And of course, you'll see people quoting Satoshi this way or that way and trying to use it as an argument for scaling one way or another. At the end of the day, it doesn't really matter what Satoshi envisioned or even what Satoshi, if he's out there, thinks today. All that really matters is what the people in the community who are participating are arguing about and deciding to move in a certain direction.
So the white paper has become like the Bible or the Quran.
Some people, yes. It is being quoted out of context in many cases.
Okay. So, now there are competitors. Litecoin, for example, is faster block times, and it's grown tremendously in market cap. So why wouldn't there just be and they adopted SegWit,
yep.
Right? So we'll get into what that means and what that is all about. So why not just move over to Litecoin for those who want more transactions?
Absolutely, and you can. And in fact, Ryan X. Charles, who is building a project called Yours, has moved his project over to Litecoin, basically citing that even with SegWit and payment channels, Litecoin is so much cheaper to create an on-chain transaction and thus open and close these off-chain payment mechanisms that it ends up being a lot better for his business model. But he will also admit that at the end of the day, Litecoin is still going to have the same on-chain scaling problems that Bitcoin has. It just happens to be able to do about 4 to 5x as much on-chain right now. But still, drop in the bucket. Like if you actually get mainstream adoption, Bitcoin, Litecoin, Ethereum, all of these cryptocurrencies are terrible at scaling right now, and they will all end up kind of buckling under the load if real mainstream adoption happens, which is why we need to find ways to scale these systems.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of mainstream adoption, we're seeing huge growth in India, for example, which makes sense because the government recently totally revamped the currency system. They got rid of all the one denomination, brought in a new denomination, remonetization, total chaos. And I think the people there are saying, why don't we just get into this cryptocurrency? It seems to work really well for us. And will they do an end run around the government? So far, I guess the topic here is regulation and governments, because governments are a little behind the curve. They're not sure what's going on, how to regulate it, if to regulate it. But in the case of India, if there's a critical mass adopts Bitcoin and Bitcoin transaction and crypto, it'll do an end run around the government. Is that a fair statement? What do you think?
Sure. In my understanding from speaking with people I know from India, I have a number of coworkers from India, is that there has been a lot of sidestepping of government taxation historically. A lot of times this would actually happen with real estate, where you go to buy a house and there's the official price and then there's the actual price, where you're paying a lot of the value of the house under the table in cash so you don't have to get taxed on it. And that was kind of the result of what a lot of the Indian government was talking about, this quote-unquote black money that they were trying to get rid of. And so it's, I think, built into the culture and the history there. Like, they already have that concept. Now the question is if they can transition to this new digital version.
Yeah, it's they have over in India the concept of blank currency with nothing on it that people use when they're asked to pay a bribe. And to emphasize that this is a bribe and I don't want to pay a bribe. And this is, as you say, it's part of the culture. It's been for quite some time. We mentioned SegWit, segregated witness. It's a technical approach to this scaling debate, and I guess if you can get into it a little bit, just kind of if you can frame it and talk about it a little bit, it'd be nice. Yeah, go ahead.
There's a lot of different plus sides to SegWit, and unfortunately, a lot of the vitriol and debate has come down to the on-chain transactions. But really, the most interesting technical part of it is the fix for what we call transaction malleability. And without going into the details, there are ways where you can create a Bitcoin transaction and then a third party can slightly modify an aspect of it that doesn't actually change any of the values or the addresses, but changes the hash, which is the fingerprint or the unique identifier. And that causes a lot of problems when you you want to do these off-chain scaling mechanisms, you need to have a hash that cannot be chained so that you can then kind of anchor in to these on-chain transactions. And in order...
So the hash is that bit that refers to the previous block.
So there are a lot of hashes in the system, but this specifically, we're talking about the hash of the transaction itself, which is just the way that we uniquely point to it, either in a block or, if it's not in a block, in the mempool. And in order to be able to point to a transaction and be sure that it will never change, no one will be able to manipulate it, you need to have a cryptographically provable, like unchangeable hash. And right now we don't have that. And it's caused a lot of problems in the past. In fact, way back in the day, Mt. Gox had a number of issues where they said, oh, it's transaction malleability. And basically they got fooled. They got fooled
That's
into
right.
thinking they
I
were doing withdrawals.
That's right. I knew that phrase brought back nightmares. It from is, the Mt. Gox days, transaction yes. malleability. That was, yes.
It is a long-standing issue in the protocol. Many people consider it a bug, and it has been used to fool people in the past to think that they had done a transaction or not done a transaction, and then people would get like multiple withdrawals out of Mt. Gox because they would tell support, oh, the transaction actually didn't happen, but what happened was they had malleated it. But that's not nearly as interesting as trying to build these second-layer networks on top of it and just needing a fix for that. Unfortunately, a lot of people are now getting kind of caught up in the on-chain, like how many on-chain transactions can happen with or without SegWit, and I think that's kind of missing the whole point of it, and I don't really bother debating about that too much.
Right. So you mentioned Mt. Gox there. So, you know, last time Bitcoin was surging toward $1,000 per Bitcoin, the Mt. Gox blew up. It was really the only game in town. It was the biggest exchange in the world. It was kind of built on an old, trading card system, if you will, and it wasn't anywhere up for the task. And the community lost hundreds of millions of dollars, and the price dropped down to 200, to just under 200, and it looked like people were writing the obituary of Bitcoin. I think there's been 150 or 160 formal obituaries of Bitcoin. But it's totally recovered since then. And you don't have that kind of single point of failure with a Mt. Gox, which was kind of the only game in town. There are
hundreds of exchanges.
Hundreds of exchanges.
Yes, definitely a lot better now. And of course, the problem was that for one reason or another, Mt. Gox was operating as a fractional reserve. And it may have been due to, you know, getting fooled by fractional or by transaction malleability. It may have been due to any number of other bugs that they had in that system. It was a very buggy system. But at the end of the day, we have
better security. Of course, now those bugs can be turned into tokens and traded on Shapeshift.
Indeed.
We'll get to cut it off there, right? We'll pick it up for our second segment, if that's okay.
Sure.
All right, well, that's going to do it for this edition of the Kaiser Report with me, Max Kaiser, and Stacey Herb. We want to thank our guest, Jameson Loop. He's the engineer at BitGo. You can catch us on Twitter at Kaiser Report. Until next time, bye, y'all.